This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of John Richardson and the Future Noughts. This week we will be discussing energy. The we is me, John Richardson, and of course the Future Noughts, Mark and Ed. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you? How's your week in lockdown been?
Well, for me, I am suffering excruciating toothache, just as all of the dentists have closed. So it's an interesting mix of parenting and unbelievable pain.
Isn't life.
And I fed, Sarah fed Flip the Fox an egg on a plate. And then this morning when I came down, I caught the fox taking a poo on a aforesaid plate.
Oh, nice. Bad egg. Yeah. Learned your lesson.
How are you, John?
I've just upgraded to Zoom Pro because I got tired of not being able to drink as much as I want because people left after 40 minutes. I had to face the decision this week on lockdown. Do I upgrade Zoom Pro as a business expense and have more meetings with you two? Or do I pay for it privately and accept that Zoom Pro is all about being able to get pissed for 2 hours rather than 40 minutes?
So it's time this week to delve into the mailbag, which it seems needs pointing out is a bag for mail, as in letters, not a bag that men enjoy on their own, which was misinterpreted by one listener this week. It's not a specifically masculine bag. And it's not a bag with testicles and penises in it. It is a bag in which letters are kept. It was just a bit of fun anyway, because nobody writes letters. It's actually just an email inbox, but I didn't want to say delve into the email inbox. But anyway, nevertheless, we have had some correspondence, and thank you for that. Gordon, not his real name, I think, because the surname is Gecko, says, hello to the Future Noughts. I discovered your show this week after a trailer for it on another podcast. So good to know the advertising work. Perhaps we'll do advertising 1 week. Is that a good topic?
Oh, it's a brilliant topic.
Yeah,
let's get into that.
And I'll tell you why it's a brilliant topic, because it also links into your work, John, is that David Ogilvy, the man who set up Ogilvy and Mather, said, make your thinking as funny as possible. All the best ideas come as jokes. And that's how he started off that whole advertising empire. So there's a big link between comedy and advertising. Because actually what you're doing in comedy is, of course, you're trying to sell a punchline, aren't you?
Desperately, absolutely. And if you go to my website now, you can find where you can come and see some of those punchlines if things ever change. Anyway, he says he's listened to all the episodes. He says, thank you, that's nice. And he also suggests an excellent Pointless Future, which is a thing called the Fliz Bike, F-L-I-Z, which is basically a sort of push bike for adults, like a balance bike that you have for kids. So it's a bike with no pedals or gears, but instead of sort of straddling it, you strap yourself into a bar that reaches over the top. I mean, I do recommend you have a look. It's a remarkable website, FLIZ bike. It's sort of like a Flintstones bicycle, basically. So instead of a car, picture pedaling it with your feet, and then presumably at some point you go downhill and you sort of lift your legs and hurtle like a maniac downhill on something which you have no control over. Yeah. But it's a nice looking thing, isn't it?
It's sort of gone backwards though, isn't it? Because that's like the original bicycle, the Velocipede, which essentially was pedal free. And then you had to sort of, at least it had a crossbar though. You weren't swinging underneath it like a piece of salami in a butcher shop window.
I think somebody behind this is cleverer than we may be giving them credit for. Because what I think they've done there is created a product that will appeal to idiots. And then when they use it, it will take them out of the gene pool because it's clearly the most dangerous vehicle ever designed.
I mean, that, if that's your idea of cleverer than you think, taking people out of the gene pool suggests, I mean, you levelled me as a psychopath. And now I think the boot's on the other foot now.
Well, it's very clear from our mailbag, John, that you are revered, isn't it? Because we've had an email from Tracy. Well, the title of the email is, "You've gained another New Zealand listener." So that's
two.
So she says, hey.
You're going to do it, are you?
I'm going to have a go. I'm
good. All right, strap in for this.
I'm here from Christchurch, New Zealand. And,
New Zealand? My goddamn Krugerrands.
Yeah. I spent some time in South Africa before I came to New Zealand.
I have diplomatic immunity here.
She says, of you, John, she says, thanks for being such a comic genius.
Oh, yes.
Yet telling stories of the world. You truly are an incredible human being, and we hope we get to have you tour down here soon. And you know that Chris, who I think is the other guy from New Zealand from last week, and I will be there.
Wow. Well, I guess at some point there'll be a travel episode, and you two could perhaps outline the ways in which I could, in a green way, travel to New Zealand to do a gig for two people. Is that
exactly
possible?
I've only done it once.
Yeah, you have. But, you know, surely, John, looking at the way your career is going, it's easy for you to travel much shorter distances to a gig for two people, isn't it?
I mean, if lockdown is nothing else, then every day is a gig to my wife and child with increasingly diminishing returns. Every meal is Hammersmith Apollo, where I've crafted my show, and then increasingly I get nothing in return, and I continue to come back to the same venue day after day because I'm not allowed to go anywhere else. Thank you as ever for all your correspondence, and if you want to get in touch with the show, here's how. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. That's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson, John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @FruCool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour.
Now, we did have one from Becky, who said she's enjoyed the podcast, and her question was, what does all this mean for the future of education? And excitingly, I can reveal that education will be next week's topic. So stay tuned for that, Becky, and indeed everyone else. Don't feel you don't need to listen just because Becky suggested the topic. But this week we are delving into the world of energy, which I guess broadly is about fuel and how we use it and what it's for. I will turn, as I always do, to you first of all, Mark and Ed, and ask, how fucked are we? How fucked is the energy world at the moment? Okay. I thought this might be quite a light one where you were able to say, well, do you know what? It's not great, but it's getting better. My impression of energy is we are tending in the right direction, and it's, compared to some of the other things we've talked about, not as bad.
God.
Oh, strap in. Let me just go and get a whiskey.
I think the reason that Ed and I are probably moaning is because we're systems thinkers and everything's interrelated. At the end of the day, almost everything that is wrong with the world comes down to what's wrong with energy, because basically the cost of everything is at some level related to the cost of energy. And the big geopolitical situation, which is also problematic, and national politics, is, when you get right down to it, somehow related to energy. And so far, it's kind of right at the center of the Gordian knot of a lot of our problems, which we shall explore in the rest of this podcast.
It's also like the very fact of sort of burning billions of years of fossilized sunshine in a little under two centuries is obviously an extraordinarily intense release of all of those bits of our fossilized ancestors, and arguably an act of dubious respect.
I think let's just look at the context, okay? Let's think about how much energy we use. Okay, so we produce, there's this figure which we use, which is MTOE, which means millions of tons of oil equivalent. Basically it's saying, so they measure energy by saying, okay, there's this much energy in a million tons of oil. How much of that energy is there in the world that we produce every year? And we produce roughly about 20,000 million tons of oil equivalent energy every year, which is an extraordinary amount of stuff that we've dug out of the ground or we've got from solar power, whatever. Now, here's the kicker. We lose 50% of it. 50% of it never gets used. It gets lost in friction. It gets lost in waste heat. It gets lost in inefficiencies in the way we produce it. It's just a complete disaster. So, for instance, so pretty much half of the climate change we have needn't happen if we didn't waste all that heat and energy. It equates to, the amount of energy we lose equates to 777 trillion boilings of your kettle, or the annual energy consumption of 10.6 billion US homes, or in fact 82 times the number of homes there are in the US, is the amount of energy that we waste that we've all actually produced. So that horrible kind of sustainability headache is twice as bad as it needs to be if the world was run more efficiently. And the costs of that, like we talked about, you know, food waste in the food episode, you know, this is like that times 100.
Well, I was going to ask about that. So you're saying we could run basically 82 Americas on the energy we lose. In food, we talked about how the food is lost from the farm to the distribution point. Where is this happening? It's obviously we're burning the fuel, we're creating the energy. Is it getting to the homes, or is it wasted in the homes, or?
Well, it's all along the journey. I mean, essentially, you know, you've got to go and find the stuff. You've got to dig it out of the ground. And, you know, it's quite dangerous and a lot of people die doing it. Then you've got to take it to a big shed and burn it at about 30% efficiency. Then you've got to crank it up to a high voltage to send it hundreds of kilometers down an electricity cable. And then you've got to make it safe to use the other end. And if people don't pay their bill, you cut them off. So all of that transmission loss and the generation loss and the waste heat and friction that Mark was talking about, that's where it's all disappearing to. So it's about as efficient as trying to, like, heat your house is like a bonfire in your living room, because we're also choking ourselves on the air pollution that comes from it. And that's a weird thing you're sort of seeing now in the COVID crisis. Everyone's talking about how clean the air is, and particularly over cities, and, you know, the Himalayas are visible above northern India and northern Indian cities for the first time in decades. But what we can't see is the fact that the carbon emissions are still there. So we've taken a lot of the smog off, but we've only actually dropped carbon emissions by about 5.5% right now, because a lot of activity, particularly in terms of heat and light, which makes about 40 or 50% of global carbon emissions, has just been transferred to our homes rather than our offices. So we're not actually cutting our carbon. And so there's this ridiculous cost on air pollution. And some of the medical studies are now also suggesting that we might be saving as many lives by having cleaner air in cities than we are losing people through coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, the World Health Organization says that air pollution is the biggest single killer of people for a single cause. So it's 1 in 8 people, they reckon, die because of air pollution. A lot of that is fossil fuels. In China, air pollution kills more people than smoking. So we've got this ridiculous system that's massively inefficient, it's massively polluting, it's delivering us climate change, and the externalities of that, the things that come out the back end of it, include potentially killing up to 1 in 8 of us through air pollution. So to ask how fucked are we, I think maximally fucked.
Maximally, yeah.
Well, I enjoyed the brief moment of optimism before I asked the question. There must have been 3.5 seconds there when I was in a relatively good mood, and I enjoyed those 3.5 seconds and the ensuing 3.5 minutes of absolutely catastrophic news. To go back to relating it to the current situation, before we talk broadly about it, I had a question in on Twitter, which was, will COVID-19 ultimately affect or wipe out the demand for fossil fuels?
Well, funnily enough, there was a report right out today from the International Energy Agency, which is chaired by the fantastic Mr. Fatih Birol. They said, I mean, and this is the International Energy Agency, remember, so this is supposed to be the objective global body. It basically said only renewables can survive what is going to be the biggest crisis for energy in 70 years. And they're talking about this massive shakedown. And partly that's to do with the extraordinary thing that's happened with the oil price, because you may have seen the news reports in the last couple of weeks where essentially the oil price has gone negative, which meant, you know, for a period in the US, oil companies were technically having to pay people to take oil away because they had nowhere to store it. And so this stuff was not only valueless, it had a cost attached to it for the producers. Now, that has obviously created complete havoc with the market capitalization values of these big fossil fuel businesses. We've got the Bank of England in the UK buying up debt for BP and Shell. And this has just happened in the space of a few short weeks. So we've gone from, you know, these titans of our pension funds, these hugely valuable businesses which declare themselves incredibly robust and actually predict that the future of energy will always have a massive role for oil and gas, have suddenly been brought to their relative knees in a matter of days. And so this then has even bigger consequences geopolitically, because we have a lot of rather dodgy countries or challenging countries around the world, not least Russia, which is about 60% dependent on hydrocarbons and fossil fuels for its foreign exchange earnings and economic turnover, as well as places like Saudi Arabia. And so the stability of those nations is suddenly then called into question when the main economic sources of revenue they have are evaporating overnight.
Yeah, and this is the dark secrets about the renewables transition that I think a lot of environmentalists who very rightly wanted to transition to renewables don't like to talk about or often don't know about, which is if you suddenly move over to renewables very, very quickly, you destabilize some of those nations. And what you don't want is a failed Russia, which also happens to have a nuclear arsenal in it. I mean, this is Vladimir Putin's fault because, you know, he has overseen the nation and he's not diversified the economy. So he's a staggering idiot. But please don't tell him I said that, because I gather he's not brilliant at looking kindly on people who disagree with his foreign policy objectives.
I'm sure he'll tweet you if he's got any objections. Why don't you play the safe bet and slag off the Saudi royal family instead? So what you're saying is, in order to save the planet and shift to renewable energies, will trigger a world war which will lead to nuclear winter and the death of us all. So, not a great outlook.
Yeah, well, I think it's all about, as Mark said, it's about a managed transition. It's about a fair and just transition. We've got this kind of bonkers system which has been evolved over decades and has actually been propped up by the resistance of some of those vested interests to maintain the status quo. It's what a futurist in America, Alex Stephan, calls predatory delay, where you have these big oil and gas companies that have actually slowed the pace of change, or indeed actively opposed the pace of change, because they make a lot of money out of the status quo. And actually the costs of that status quo are borne by all of us. Now, that clearly has to change. And so we have to accelerate that process. But we do need to have a just transition. We need to reskill and redeploy people in terms of their jobs. And obviously, there's a lot of offshore engineering expertise which can be redeployed into building wind farms, etc. But also, we have to find a way of allowing countries to transition their economies and not just flick the switch overnight and watch them descend into chaos.
This all goes back to something that the industry talks about, which is called the energy trilemma. So what they say is that energy is this kind of triple horned beast, and you can never satisfy it, because what we want is cheap energy. We want it secure, it's always there, and safe, you know, and it needs to be sustainable. And what they say is that actually you can't have those three things at the same time. You can have it cheap and everybody gets it, but it won't be sustainable. You can have it sustainable and everybody gets it, but it will be really expensive, and so on and so forth. So none of that's true, of course, but that is what they like to say, because then they say, well, it's not our fault. It's just, you know, it's just the way it is. There are ways out of this.
Yeah, I was going to ask, in your industry then, working with companies and looking at the future and how we progress to the more ecological and fair society we want to live in, are you within those circles having to advocate for a continuation of fossil fuels, or is there a way that you can say, well, we can stop that immediately, but we need to do these things? Or do you have to say, well, okay, we're going to have to, for example, going back to what you're saying about the efficiency of the system, if we were able to make the system more efficient, would you then need to burn half as much fuel because you're not losing so much that you create?
Well, some of that comes down just to the inefficiency of centralized generation, unfortunately, John. I mean, this is the problem where you have the big sheds that I referred to earlier. So if you're burning things like coal and gas, those inefficiencies are built in. There's not much you can do, because a thermal power station is a relatively inefficient way of generating electricity. And also long distance transmission lines, you can insulate the cables, you can put them under the ground, but that's incredibly expensive and it wouldn't actually save a dramatic percentage, certainly not enough to allow us to continue burning fossil fuels at the same level. So you partly have to look at that efficiency, yes, but really it's about reduction of that use and then scaling up renewables to do the replacement part. But the issue here is about whether we can actually scale renewables to replace fossil fuels like for like. And I think ultimately we still need to be looking at a reduction in overall use. Or, you know, for example, in the UK, we basically need to triple the amount of electricity we're producing now if we wanted to replace fossil fuels like for like. And that's an incredibly tall order, because whilst we're making good inroads in terms of renewable energy generation into our grid mix, the mix of electricity being provided on the grid at the moment, you know, to then say, and now we need three times as much, I think that's a stretch.
How has that happened then? How are we in this position? Is it that demand has increased exponentially and the system, as inefficient as it is already, isn't able to keep up? Or have we just not, as you mentioned earlier, we've sort of seen it coming, but the people that saw it coming didn't want to do anything about
it? Yeah, I mean, and partly it's about price again. I mean, energy has been too cheap. We have reduced the price of energy, so people have become profligate with it. And so we don't look at the ways of saving it. And, you know, another good example is perhaps the way that the online world has grown very rapidly in the last 20 years. The amount of data we now collect and store, 90% of the world's data has been collected in the last 2 years. And that means that there's this tsunami of data that we're aggregating could be using up 20% of global electricity by 2025. You know, whilst we might make some inroads in efficiency, we then have a whole new sector of our economy, which is actually hungrily eating up all the savings we're making elsewhere. And so part of the problem is the price has been too low, so we've been too profligate with it, and we're also adding lots of additional energy demands into the system.
So you should immediately switch off this podcast.
Well, I feel like, I mean, I don't want to take credit for being an early adapter, but I've been on at people about their unread emails for a long time. I used to, in shows, ask for people's phones, and if they had more than 1,000 unread emails, I would ask them to leave the room, because that information is stored somewhere. That Domino's offer exists as a thing. To check the stat again, a fifth of all the electricity at some point is predicted to be storage of data.
By 2025.
That's in 5 years.
Yeah.
Helping you out with the maths there. Trying to keep those countdown skills sharp while we're not recording.
One of the other things that Mark and I often talk about is, you know, is this the dilemmas of the exponentials, you know, because sometimes these demands on the system have meant exponential growth. And you essentially have got a sort of exponential growth in data storage, which is what's creating this enormous energy demand. And at the minute, less than a fifth of that data storage comes from renewable energy. It's an extraordinary problem. It contributes to, you know, one of the biggest challenges we face.
And it is the fundamental challenge that we face, because of the way the energy is priced and where it comes from. All that limits or increases the choices we have to deal with all our other problems, whether that's, you know, providing a social safety net, the cost of healthcare, cost of education, how we farm, all that kind of stuff. So it's the big daddy or the big mummy or the central baby or whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's the central baby. And when it is, as Mark said, it's, you know, what basically the way the energy system works at the moment is you have these big centralized sort of generators, you know, who will generate electricity. They send it down the big cable. So it's basically like a heavily centralized one-way linear industrial pipe. And you sit at the end of it and you have to pay your bill. So the problem is it's not in anyone's interest. It's not really in the interest of the energy companies for you to use less energy or to be more energy efficient, which is why they've always dragged their feet over doing it, because they're quite happy for you to use more because they get paid more for that. So, you know, there's not been massive incentivization. The government has tried various different schemes, but at the end of the day, you know, it's the same way the supermarkets don't necessarily want you to stop wasting food, because they're quite happy if you're buying a third more than you actually eat and putting it in the compost bin, because they're getting paid for it.
So we've had a question on sort of personal liability. One of the questions was about whether we would need a planning permission to put a wind turbine on our house. Is that a relevant question? I mean, the sort of level of depression I'm feeling at the moment based on the start of this conversation, I don't want to put the answer in your mouth, but the answer I'm feeling is, are you fucking serious? A fucking wind turbine? We're all going to be dead in 5 years. Did you not listen to Ed and Mark? But there obviously is an element that we do have to take responsibility and do what we can to make our own homes and lives more efficient.
Also depends where you live. I mean, if you live at the bottom of a valley, then putting a wind turbine on your roof is probably not going to be very effective.
I do live at the bottom of a valley. We have frequent flooding. What about sort of hydroelectric dams or something?
Yeah, well, exactly. And there's all sorts of different things you could do along that front. I mean, this comes back to partly the challenge of the grid, because the grid is very good for the big centralized connections. But, you know, the whole point of having your own wind turbine would be that you would then have a grid connection. So you would use some of your own electricity, and then you perhaps hopefully be able to sell some back into the rest of the grid. But the trouble is our grid is so shonky that, you know, it's a bit like you have this wonderful, highly insulated high-grade copper connections for most of the big links. And then suddenly you have a Welsh hill farmer with a wind turbine who's on the kind of wiring equivalent of a piece of wet, hairy string in a field. And he's going, and I want to sell my electricity back into the grid. And you can't do it because the cabling's not up to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, this all comes, I think, to the central, how do we fuck ourselves? And that is to think about how we generate and use energy much closer to where it's generated. So the reason it's centralized is because that was the best way to do it in the past. We didn't have any other way. I like to say that, you know, the sun is waving this massive energy paycheck in our face every single day. I can't remember the exact statistic, but there's this statistic that goes around that, you know, like 80 times more energy hits the earth in a day or something than we use in an entire year. So it's not that we haven't got a lack of energy coming into the planet. But we had no way to bank that and use it where it was arriving. So what we did was we went into the savings account, which is fossil fuels. We've become addicted to this cheap, easy source, this fix, which was the fossil fuels. And it was being stored. That's the other thing. The great thing about fossil fuels from an energy perspective is that they are their own battery in that, you know, they sit there and they'll sit there for a long time. Then when you need them, you just have to set fire to them. Whereas a sunbeam, you know, it's gone. So how do you turn that into something you can either use right now or store, and storage is one of the ways that we get ourselves out of this problem. So it's about a massive reimagining of our relationship with the sun, essentially, and how we take the energy it's giving us, use it as it arrives, or store it locally to be used locally when we need it, in conjunction with the grid as well, because the grid actually has some very useful properties, which is if it's dark in your part of the world and it's sunny somewhere else, it'd be quite good to be able to exchange that energy over some kind of network system. So that's, and there's a lot of work going on to that, things, you know, smart grids and grids across continents and all that kind of stuff. So it's not that people aren't thinking about this, but it is a huge philosophical challenge, financial challenge, and logistical challenge, because of course all the way that energy markets work and the way that we buy energy and the way we trade it has all been built around a very centralized system with a few big players controlling lots of it, which is why, you know, the news always breathlessly reports on whatever OPEC is thinking, and we've got to, you know, go and move away from that and start to think of energy much more locally produced and used.
Yeah, it's changing a lot, isn't it? Because, I mean, if you look now, we've basically got six, we always talk about the big six major energy providers in the UK. But if you go back to the turn of the 20th century, there were about 600 local energy generating businesses across the UK. It was genuinely in this sort of radical relocalization. And when Mark and I used to do our live shows as the Future Nauts, we used to talk about this as energy density, and actually the challenge being that over the years, since we're our first sort of beyond wood, you know, the most energy dense fuel we could get was actually whale oil. So, you know, we'd send ships off down to the South Atlantic, harpooning whales in the head and then rendering them down into oil. And the streets of Britain were lit by burning whale oil. And that was because that was the most energy dense fuel we could lay our hands on. And then, of course, you know, we got coal and gas and oil, and all of those have, as Mark said, this great intense storage capacity. Now, the problem with renewables, it's not insoluble, but obviously renewables are harder to store and they're a bit less dense and they are less controllable and predictable.
It's interesting to point out that when fossil fuels were arriving, they were considered environmental alternatives to slaughtering, you know, whales. I mean, there was this worry about, you know, peak whale.
Whale
shortage, because we were out there sort of, you know, slaughtering whales so that we could burn our candles or whatever, and people were saying, well, you know, what about these new fuels, you know, like kerosene and gasoline, because you don't have to send out loads of men into dangerous environments and these ships to battle these huge leviathans, and you don't have to kill these innocent animals, and the energy is just as dense and it doesn't smell of whale. Yeah. Surely there's some room for these new environmentally positive alternatives. So we're going through that argument kind of again now.
Well, with a thriving liposuction industry now, is there an argument for a return?
Now, that is a reality TV show. Wait a minute. It's like Love Island meets Tomorrow's World.
So I feel we should, earlier than we would usually, move on to the unfucking part of the situation, because the problems are huge and imminent. But briefly, before we get onto that, you always talk, Mark, about the difficulty of these transitions. Are we talking about, it seems like the problems are so urgent that we need to do something quickly. Does a part of that mean looking at, again,
temporary energy shortages or a limit on what times people can use energy, or is there a way of doing it more seamlessly?
I think there are ways of doing it more seamlessly. And with, as with all these problems, it comes down to what amount of will we have. So, for instance, we could change the way we tax energy. We could change the way we subsidize it. We could change the incentives in the market for, you know, which types of production are going to be favored or not. We could introduce different types of regulation. And as Ed was talking about, the resistance to that has been enormous. Now, there are some pretty good arguments from the fossil fuel lobby, as you'd say, to say, well, look, you know, people need energy. They need it to survive. They need it to cook. They need it to run their businesses. They need it to have decent lives, you know. And actually, we've got this whole system that is currently, you know, pretty cheap and delivers it there, and it's got storage and whatever. So, you know, all very well, you know, Mr. Middle Class Environmentalist, but, you know, we want to deliver energy to people where they need it. And so that argument often holds a lot of sway with governments, of course, because they're having to look after their populations. However, it doesn't actually, when you dig down into it, doesn't bear an awful lot of fruit, because what you're doing is just kicking the problem down the road. Say, well, yes, we're helping people now so that we can destroy their future later with climate change. The great thing about renewables technology and battery technology now is, like the internet, the storage that we just talked about, you know, it is moving exponentially. Things are getting more and more efficient. They're getting cheaper to produce. I mean, the cost of wind generation now in the UK is by far and unarguably the cheapest way to produce electricity in the UK, cheaper than coal. So, you know, when that starts to happen, then things do move quite quickly.
And just to lever in a brief ray of sunshine, I loved it, Mark, when you talked about when it's sunny on the other side of the planet and it's dark here, that we can share that. I mean, that I'm not a spiritual man. I'm dead on the inside, but I almost thought I could put that on a T-shirt and flog them. But to provide a brief ray of sunshine, we are in the UK. Didn't we last year go a record amount of time without any fossil fuel usage in terms of our supply from the grid?
Well, we've just beaten that. Actually, we're going the longest amount of time since the Industrial Revolution coal-free. I think we've just done 18 days completely coal-free. And actually, the grid mix in recent weeks in the UK, well, we've had quite a bit of sun and quite a bit of wind. It's been about 40% wind energy on electricity and about 20% solar. So 60% of our electricity has been coming from wind and solar, which is really, really amazing. And partly what you're alluding to in terms of sharing the electricity around, John, as well. There's lots of discussions about a sort of European super grid, you know, which would connect in to solar farms and solar installation facilities in Northern Africa and in the Mediterranean. You combine that with the kind of the Western front, if you like, of Europe along the coast of Britain and Ireland and Norway, with wind coming in off the Atlantic. And then you have the Scandinavians have a lot of hydropower. Then you're able to balance that energy need and demand across large scales. But again, I come back to this point. I said, I think there probably has to be some kind of radical efficiency and moderation of demand management to take down the demand levels if we're going to see a kind of a genuine transformation and replacement of fossil fuels with enough complementary renewables in a combined mix.
And what does that mean when you talk about reduced usage? What do you mean, as an individual, that we reshape sort of our lives, or are you talking about companies or infrastructure?
Well, I think it's a mixture of everything, but part of the biggest challenge we have on energy in the UK is refitting and retrofitting 25 million homes. So, you know, that's our housing stock, and it's really not fit for purpose in terms of energy. You know, it's leaky, it's expensive and intensive to heat. You know, we can make big inroads into lighting by replacing everything with LEDs, and lighting is around about 25% of our electricity consumption. But the heating is the killer. We've basically got to try and shift from having most of those homes, so tens of millions of them, working on gas central heating, and some of them, the more remote ones, on oil, onto electrical heating. And that is going to cost billions. Although arguably, that's a much better kind of infrastructure investment as a collective nation than spending money on something like HS2. And it would probably benefit people in a more direct and immediate ways and create more jobs and more meaningful work for folk. And obviously, it would benefit everyone. So I think you know, we have the capacity, we have the skills, we have the know-how, we know how to build new zero carbon homes. It's not like we are looking for new innovations or solutions. It's, as Mark said, it's to what extent we have the political will to do what needs to be done over the timescales it needs to be done.
And I think this also comes back to the thing that, that Ed often comes back to, which is the story we tell ourselves about how things are done. So we've all grown up in a world in which energy is produced in this particular way, and that, you know, the big titans of industry were the oil companies. And, you know, when the UK got North Sea oil, it was considered like this amazing, brilliant, you know, boost for the nation. So there's a lot of inbuilt, systemic, deep-rooted stuff that says, well, this is just the way we do it. And I often like to do this thought experiment, you know, like, you know, imagining my grandchildren coming to me and saying, so let me get this right, granddad. Like, in your day, they used to dig up this stuff from the ground that had been there for millions of years and burn it, but it was really inefficient and it caused climate change, but there wasn't enough of it, or the people went to war over it and it caused all these massive geopolitical problems and tensions, and you had to pay for it, and if you didn't pay for it, they cut you off.
I think they're coming for you now, aren't they? I'm some sirens in the background.
And I go, yeah, that's how we did it. And they go, but granddad, it's pouring for free out of the sky. That's a ridiculous way of doing things. And I think what we've got, you know, as with so many of the problems that Ed and I deal with, is we have a culture of doing it one way that is embedded such that it can't see a new way, or even when it can see a new way, it doesn't know how to go for it. And that's kind of, you know, mine and Ed's job is helping people make that transition. And it can be done. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about dongs, or let's talk about the big dong.
That's the title of your band's new album, right?
So Dong it was the rather unfortunately named Danish oil and natural gas company, and they no longer do oil or natural gas. They moved their entire operation over to renewables, and they are a very successful renewable energy company. So it's not about demonizing the energy companies or demonizing part of what they do, which is providing energy. Nobody has a problem with you providing energy. What we need now is a way to do it that doesn't destroy our prosperity. And there's a whole bunch of really talented engineers and project managers and all sorts of people in those businesses who, if the narrative said, look, it's okay to redeploy yourself over here and you can still have as much value, then that's a good thing. And this, again, comes to these two things. You need the money to move, and the money is moving now, especially with the COVID thing. I mean, a whole bunch of oil and gas companies are about to go bust because of what's happening with the drop in oil demand. And you need a social signal, and that's where things like Extinction Rebellion come in and say, look, this is no longer acceptable to us. And when you get those two things moving together, as they seem to be at the moment, then you might get the change we need. But the point now is we have left it right down to the wire. So we've got to go fast on this. And coming out of the COVID crisis, there is a lot of talk, particularly in Europe, of tying the rebooting of the economy and the helping out of the various businesses that have been disrupted and are getting loans or whatever, tying that aid that's given to those businesses with, you get this and you continue to get it if you green yourselves, if you move over to a more sustainable way of doing things. And I think that's a very positive possible outcome of what's happening to us right now.
So all these ifs, I'll be honest with you, a thought that haunts me since you mentioned it, and it's because we're on lockdown and it's very relevant, but is something we talked about in the first show, that we had the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918, followed by the Roaring Twenties, because following a period of hardship, there was, I know it's not as simple as that link, but there was also a desire to, well, let's party then. Yeah. The longer lockdown goes on, the longer I get a sense of, I mean, I cannot tell you how much I want to fly around the world and get pissed in every bar in the world. That's my goal for when this ends, which obviously, you know, is difficult for someone who's trying not to fly anymore. How hard is it going to be to implement those ifs now when we come out of this lockdown situation? And I'm interested that one thing we haven't talked about yet is nuclear power, because Paul sent a question on Twitter asking about the difference between fusion and fission, and he said, how long until a point where we get safe and efficient nuclear power? And is it not more likely that we are, and I know Ed, you've mentioned this, we are going to sort of try and keep things roughly as they are and look at something like nuclear as a way of saying, well, actually, if we just change that a little bit, then that can provide a lot of power and it's sort of the system we already use?
Yeah, well, it's like, I mean, I always say if nuclear power is the answer, you're asking the wrong question. The thing with nuclear fusion is it's always 50 years away. It's always a technology which is going to be with us in a few decades, and it's going to solve everything. With the existing nuclear fission, We have this, I think it's a big problem because it's about opportunity cost. I mean, with, even beyond all the kind of serious environmental concerns about the generation and the storage of the nuclear waste, it is about the infrastructural cost of building the things in the first place and also then running them, because nuclear is not either carbon free or cheap to run. The thing is, you could actually deploy renewables to the same level of capacity almost immediately for a cheaper level of cost, as Mark's already touched on. And so you end up with these big potential white elephants, and Hinkley C, which is a nuclear power station we're currently building in the UK, you know, will probably end up being the most expensive man-made object on the planet in history, with an expected price tag of around about £24-25 billion. And that's assuming we kind of bring it in on budget and on time, which, let's face it, we don't exactly have a fantastic track record of doing. So I think nuclear probably has a role in terms of managing out the existing infrastructure we currently have. But I'm very, very wary about the impacts and the debts and the obligations and the high energy prices, actually, that we tie ourselves into. Because whilst the unit price of solar and wind is coming down, in order to justify the private finance that goes in to building these new nuclear power stations, we have to guarantee the energy prices we will pay for the electricity they produce for the next 50 years. And so, you know, when we might be getting very, very cheap wind and solar power, even in the next 10 years, we could be paying for very expensive nuclear power right up until the middle of the century.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the price that the government has agreed to pay for electricity coming out of Hinkley C is more expensive than wind is now. So they're committing to a price in the future that's more expensive than what we can generate now. And then there's another fundamental problem with nuclear, which is about the ownership model, which is you've still got a centralized generation capacity that is owned by a very small number of people and companies. And that, and when you can think about things like energy justice and who gets to use it and who controls the flow of energy, when you have centralized systems, it doesn't matter whether it's a centralized by government or centralized in the private sector. If you get too much power in too few hands, you get one of two things. You get incompetence at best, because everything's a bit too easy, or inefficiency at best, and you get corruption at worst. And the energy market is a massive example of both. So while there are, you know, potentially some, you know, credible, depending on how you look at them, arguments that nuclear is more green, it still keeps us in this centralized, power concentrated ownership model, which we all know comes with huge political and economic and societal headaches.
Yeah, and I think that's the really interesting thing, is that you could imagine doing a national retrofit to eliminate fuel poverty. So actually, we have nobody in this country who gets cold and uncomfortable and dies alone of a chill in the winter. Plus, you know, we need to level the playing field, because if you are generating your own electricity through a solar array or your own wind turbine or a community project, you actually get paid less at the minute for the electricity you generate than the big generators get paid. So we want to level that playing field as well, and to make the grid into a much more sort of dynamic two-way exchange system where everyone's getting the same price. Because building on what Mark's saying, you know, that means we could ultimately have a system which is much more interconnected. It would be a bit like power to, by, and for the people. And it would prevent these kind of monopolies of control and these high prices being manipulated. And it would give us all an ownership stake in the clean, green energy system that we really want.
And it would boost the economy, you know. So it works left wing and right wing, because if you get to a system like that, and I visited towns that have done it. So in my last book, sorry, Ed.
Does that mean the most recent book, or does that mean you're not writing anymore?
So a few years ago, I went to this town called Güssing in Austria, and it's known as a pioneer in renewable energy. And this is a town that was sort of right next to the Iron Curtain. So it had half of its trading partners cut off, and it was basically an economic basket case. It had the highest levels of unemployment in pretty much all of Europe, very high levels of degradation, no investment coming in. And the mayor and the chief engineer of the town sort of, what are we going to do? And they worked out they were spending €6 million a year on energy collectively as a town, when you added up what everybody individually was spending, plus the municipal government, plus the local businesses. And they realized that all that money was flowing somewhere else. That €6 million that's going out of this town that we could really do with. If we had that in the town and that was circulating in the local economy, then things would be very different. So they set about moving the entire town over to renewables. And everybody said they were crazy and said they couldn't do it, but they did do it. And in the last book, I explored a lot of the problems they had in doing that, but they succeeded. And now that town is a boom town. They've got half the electricity price of neighboring towns. So what does that mean? Well, local businesses go, where am I going to set up? I'm going to set up over there because one of my biggest costs, electricity, is half. So now, you know, from being in an economic basket case, by taking control of the energy locally and keeping that money moving in the local economy, that town is now a destination town for businesses. So it's good for the economy as well, but it's a version of the economy which is much more locally focused, where money flows more locally. And this is what, you know, if you get energy flowing more locally, you get money flowing more locally.
But I think the point Mark's making there about relocalization is really important, actually, John, going back to one of the questions you were asking earlier. It's like, what would need to change? Because I was reading a report just this morning, actually, where they were talking about if you take the kind of carbon footprint of a tin of tomatoes, which is transported across border between countries, so, and you compare that with the carbon footprint of locally produced tomatoes, it's 5 times more carbon intensive, more energy intensive for the tin of tomatoes. And so if you actually relocalize the economy as well, you remove a lot of those transportation and shipping costs. And that is where you can also save vast amounts of energy.
So another possible solution, to be honest, I got more questions about this than nuclear when I asked, was hydrogen. One question is, when is the UK going to switch from methane to hydrogen for its gas supply? When are we going to have hydrogen boron fusion? What are your thoughts on hydrogen as a solution?
Well, that's 2 separate questions there. So the second one, which is the hydrogen boron fusion, which is basically, you know, nuclear power by fusion. As has often been said, nuclear fusion is that wonderful, you know, silver bullet that produces vast amounts of energy that's always been 30 years away. And if you ask fusion scientists now, they kind of have got wise to that. So they're now saying 15 years, but they really mean
50. Right. You've done B, which was hydrogen boron fusion.
Ed, do you want to do A?
Methane to hydrogen. I mean, hydrogen has a massive role to play, but again, it's another one of these huge infrastructural shifts. And I think we're not yet clear how we will use hydrogen. Will we generate hydrogen from our excess renewable energy capacity? So we'll use the electricity we generate from that to kind of create hydrogen as a storage of energy, which we could then perhaps put into vehicles or then burn to turn back into electricity. So it gives us a way of evening out the kind of the renewable peaks and troughs. Or is hydrogen going to be something that we do on a much more localized basis? I don't know. Mark, what's your view?
I mean, I'll go with the Committee for Climate Change on this, which they say it's useful in parts, but what we really should be doing is electrifying everything. So rather than moving your boiler over to hydrogen, you really should be moving it over to being an electric boiler. And of course, the price of electric boilers has to come down and whatever. But it seems like it is a potential pathway, but it would have been much more potential pathway if we'd have been really serious about an energy transition 30 or 40 years ago, because by then the hydrogen technology would have got to where we need it. And right now, it's kind of catching up, and we've actually got some other alternatives that we can deploy right now and much cheaper that are sustainable. So, you know, the Committee for Climate Change, which is the government's own advisors on climate change, and are often really mean to the government, going like, I know we're your official advisors, but you really are fucking this up quite horribly. I mean, they recently described the government's response. And remember, these are the government's own appointed advisors. They recently described the government's response to climate change as a bit like Dad's army. So
still a source of comfort to many in difficult times.
I think the other thing is actually where we use cutting edge technology in terms of like trying to even out the peaks and troughs of renewables. There's another friend of ours who runs a thing called Open Climate Fix, and he's doing what they call now casting of solar and wind generation. And that's essentially taking satellite data and weather data and mapping that against a map of the UK wind and solar grid. So where we've got all the kind of turbines and the solar panels. And that way you can then almost predict using artificial intelligence and machine learning how much electricity will be coming from the UK's solar panels and how much will be coming from the wind turbines on a 4-hour cycle. So it's quite immediate now casting, he calls it, rather than forecasting. That means you can then turn down the fossil fuel base load supply. So most of our spinning base load on the grid, it comes from gas-fired power stations. And if we know how much we're going to get from renewables, we can turn down that fossil fuel base load and save a lot of fossil fuels and therefore carbon emissions. So I think there's some very clever stuff we can do like that as well.
That's very exciting. Are there any more of those that you want to tell us about before perhaps mark something from your first book?
There are all sorts of fascinating things going on in energy. The great thing about the energy market is, despite the old school oil firms and their sort of lip service really to innovation, because it's such a big market and because it's a problem that's present everywhere, and the need to have energy, the amount of innovation is through the roof. If you think about climate change, for instance, if you go to Cornwall, their biggest contributor to climate change is methane emissions from slurry pits on farms. So there is a technology company called Bennamon down there. They're taking that methane and turning it into a liquid fuel that you can use to power your tractors on the farm. So they're closing that loop. And that's just one example. And that goes back to Ed's earlier point, was those farmers, there was no point in them getting solar or wind, because any excess energy they had, they couldn't export off the farm because the electricity connection was so crappy. Now, if they've got any spare methane, they can go and sell it. So basically, the whole energy system is massively leaky. And one of the reasons it's massively leaky is because the people in the center don't really care about the little leaks here, there, and everywhere. But you add up all those leaks, if you close them all, A, we'd be able to use that stuff locally, and B, we wouldn't need such an inefficient centrally generated system. So it's a cultural shift. But when you say, the other thing about energy is money. If you say to a farmer, you see that bunch of waste over there, I'm going to take that and I'm going to take away your fuel bill at the same time. You know, it doesn't have to be a committed environmentalist or even a genius to go, yeah, that's a good idea. And that's why it lies at the root of all of our problems, really, is that our relationship with energy has been hidden from us by the current system, where we think it just comes from some pipe or whatever, and actually it's pouring out the sky, and we need to work out how we capture it for ourselves, use it for ourselves in a way that's good for our local economies and good for the planet.
There was a point there when you said they take the methane from all the slurry and turn it into a liquid that I was almost sick, but then I understood you meant a liquid fuel.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, because the big sort of debate that I, as a sort of layman in this, it's always the, can renewables replace fossil fuels in the short term? And it sounds like, from what you're saying, there's actually a number of different solutions. And globally, it's about fitting the right solution to the right area and empowering that area to be more self-sufficient than it currently is. Is that sort of what you're saying? Or have I misunderstood?
Yeah, Stanford University did a big study on this a couple of years ago, where they actually looked over 100 different countries around the world. And they looked at the different resources and the different kind of meteorology and the right conditions in each nation. And like I was saying earlier, across Europe, you know, Scandinavians have a lot of hydro, west coast of Britain and Ireland has a lot of wind, Mediterranean countries have a lot of solar. And what Stanford University did was basically mapped out the pathways to taking all of those 100 countries to zero carbon by 2050 with their own particular mix of different complementary technologies. And that's the other thing, you know, the renewables energy system is much more resilient ultimately because you're not exposed to massive volatility of pricing of fossil fuels. You hopefully have a degree of predictability, but also you have multiple different elements within them, which should give you a better overall resilience en masse.
I mean, there's a really important point here that Ed raises about the volatility of the oil price. So the cost of energy goes up and down all the time, depending on what OPEC does, depending on geopolitical problems or whatever. And that makes it very hard to plan things. So economists don't agree on much. In fact, the collective noun for economists is a disagreement. But they do agree on one thing. They agree on a few things. One of the things they agree on is that trade is good. The more that we trade with each other, the less we kill each other. The other thing they tend to agree on is that low energy prices are good, because low energy prices stimulate the economy, because the energy price affects the price of everything else. And the other thing they all agree on, but talk about less often, is that stable energy prices are good, because that gives you predictability. You know what things are going to cost some distance from now if the energy price stays stable. Now, you know, some argument happens in the Gulf or COVID happens or whatever, and the energy price goes all over the place and causes chaos for all sorts of people. And you don't know whether the price is going up or down. You move over to renewables, you know, what happened to the price of sunshine yesterday? It stayed exactly the same, actually, at pretty much zero, in that the sun comes free. And so there are towns now in central Texas that have moved over to renewables for the town's energy because it's cheaper than using oil in central Texas. But more importantly, Dale Ross, for instance, is the Republican mayor of a very, you know, conservative town called Georgetown in central Texas, says, I just know what my electricity bill is going to be 20 years from now. So when I'm planning big projects, whether that's, you know, a hospital or a new bypass or whatever, I can do that with confidence for my citizens without this horrible volatility of the oil price. And that's when a whole bunch of people in his town are working in the oil industry. But even they've decided that it's better to use renewables. So there's this massive economic dividend of stability. But that stability takes a lot of power away from people like Vladimir Putin and the Saudis because they quite like to use that lever. I mean, and Putin has used it on a case. Say, well, if you carry on, you know, annoying me, I'll just turn off the pipes, and that's going to affect quite a lot of people in Europe. So you do what I say. You know, removing that kind of economic bullying from the geopolitical system is not a bad idea, and that's another great thing about renewables.
Well, you've led me to exactly the point the question was going to be, that the big worry I have and the itch in the back of my brain is still that in the short term, how do we help those countries whose economies are entirely built on the system at the moment not leverage that power in a very negative and harmful way?
Well, this is where the politics of it comes in. And this is where you have to have those conversations, which, you know, ask difficult questions, which is, at some point, do we have to have a conversation with Russia where we say, well, actually, we will support you to move to a different type of economy?
I'm picturing a world in which people are asked, you know, a sort of global fund to pay into some of the richest nations on earth in terms of the resource they've already made. And
exactly.
I don't think people would be best pleased by that idea.
No. And this was already happening before the COVID crisis, to be honest. You know, we already had a sort of price war going on, because I think what we've seen in the kind of climate clampdown, where we're trying to reduce the kind of production of fossil fuels, you've already seen a sort of zero-sum game starting to play out, with the Saudis effectively looking around the world and going, well, we've got the biggest, most easily accessible and cheapest to extract oil reserves on the planet. At some point, there might well be a control on this globally, so we might as well sell what we can while we can for whatever price we can get, and put everyone else out of business in the process. And that was already happening before the COVID crisis kicked in, which is one of the reasons where suddenly, you know, you've seen the global demand plummet, which has then dropped the price and turned it negative. And again, all of this is entirely predictable.
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia were already kind of like, you know, kicking Russia in the nuts already by saying, well, you know, there's going to be a problem with climate change, so we'll pile it high and sell it cheap, and we can sell it cheaper than you, so they're going to buy it from us, and we've got more of it than you have. And Russia's going, you can't do that to us. We've got, you know, we've got enough money reserved to see you through this problem. And it was just this, I mean, it's ridiculous kind of bun fight with the global economy and people's lives. And that's another thing that renewables, especially locally generated renewables, removes us from. But, you know, you've got a huge amount of big dicks swinging around that don't like that. But fuck them, I say.
If you've got this thing happening now where they're able to do that and flood the market, and is there anybody saying to them now, look, you can do this in the short term, but this extra money you're making, you have to start transitioning away from this economy?
Yeah, well, the thing is, they're not making any money at the minute. They're actually losing money. So, you know, as I say, it's like they've gone and they've just busted their hand in poker. Because what we've had for some time is basically global fossil fuel producing nations all playing poker, all saying we can burn everything we've got, you know, and still keep the world within 1.5 degrees, but not revealing the fact that actually clearly that's not the case. Some of this stuff has to stay in the ground. And I think the big question in regard to the compensation you propose, John, is that how do you do this in a just transition? Because the last time we had a bailout like that, you know, not in 2008, I'm talking going way back, where, you know, essentially the energy that was being put into the system was human slave labor. So when we, in the era of slavery, people used to make the same arguments about slaves as they do currently about fossil fuels. Our economy would crumble without them. You know, they are literally and kind of terribly the backbone of the economy. And when we turned around, and we had the emancipation of slaves, it was one of the biggest compensation bailouts that had ever been paid in British financial history. And the compensation didn't go to the slaves, it went to the slave owners. And we actually didn't finish paying off the final interest payments on that compensation until 2015. So, you know, I agree we need a just transition, but at the same time, I'm not particularly in favor of compensating businesses which have driven us to the brink of the edge of the cliff on climate change and are now turning around begging to the government and the Bank of England for bailouts because suddenly they're experiencing really dramatic financial problems. Understandably, my sympathy is a little waned.
Yeah, I'm totally with Ed on that. The kicker, of course, is that Russia is a nuclear arsenal, and you don't want a failed Russian state in any way, shape or form, because that's potentially unleashes problems that are worse than the problems we've already got.
Well, the one relief, ending on where we started, the idea of a global nuclear meltdown, the one relief is that it's not my job to solve that. Tell me, and most of the people listening who aren't involved in these peace talks with Russia and the Saudis, can you offer anything that we can do individually, short term, to help drive forward to a better system?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, the obvious thing is sign up to a renewable energy provider today. I mean, you can buy renewable energy from a number of different businesses, from Good Energy to Ecotricity to Octopus Energy to Bulb. They all have slightly different benefits depending on how technically geeky you want to get. But the fact is, what we need is to see a movement of people demanding renewable energy from their energy provider. You can usually get it at the same price, if not cheaper these days when you do a combined tariff. And interestingly, you know, there are even some tariffs out there which, during these periods of intense sunshine and high winds, people are getting paid to use energy during the day. So, you know, actually those negative energy prices we talked about in the context of fuel can actually happen on some domestic energy tariffs. So there's both a huge environmental and an economic incentive to sign up to the right provider. So anyone can do that tomorrow.
Lovely. Done it. Mark?
Well, if you've got any investments or you're looking at your pension, it's probably time now to say to whoever's managing them that I would like them to transition out of fossil fuels, because you're not a big enough shareholder to have any influence on the board. You want the big investors to be doing that. But you can send a big cultural signal, and you're changing the way the investment world thinks by doing that. And that just sends this very underlying big signal back to society. You know, as Gandhi said, what you do may be insignificant, but it's really important that you do it. And when it comes to energy, even the tiniest signal you send will aggregate with everybody else's. And that's part of the reason that Ed and I do what we do and why we do this podcast, is kind of like, we can amplify that a little bit. Then we're hastening to that point where hopefully things get a lot better. And the other thing you can do is insulate your house.
Well, busy week ahead. we end, as we always do, on pointless futures, the designs and ideas that are taking the world in the wrong direction. Mark, I believe you have one for us this week.
Yeah, I came across this. It is the world's first interactive smart salt dispenser.
At last. My God. So the moment you said it, I thought, how have I lived this long without one?
So basically, have you ever looked, you know, at the salt cellar on your table and thought, what that needs is a Bluetooth speaker and an app such that if I want some salt, I have to get my phone out, shake my phone whilst holding this device in the other hand to dispense some salt. It also has ambient mood lighting attached to it. It's meant to make the mealtime more, I don't know, smart. And it's supposed to be a sense, it's supposed to be a talking point, your salt dispenser. And I just have to feel that anybody who is so bereft of social skills that they think a condiment or a smart condiment is the way to make friends and influence people is probably not going to be having dinner parties anyway, are they?
Nothing says romance like the soft lighting of a salt dispenser.
So it's a salt cellar that makes it harder to get salt. Wow. So they're basically taking... What they really want to sell is a Bluetooth speaker with a light that goes in the middle of the table, but they've branded it around the shittest part of what it does.
Exactly.
It's more of a speaker that can give you salt than a salt cellar that can play
music.
No,
no, John. It's the world's first interactive centerpiece.
So that's it for this week. I am in awe of both of you. That was a pleasure to listen to. I don't feel I did a lot, but thank you for your insight and your wit. No. We will be back next week with another episode. If this episode has launched any questions in your mind, you can reach us on the usual platforms, and they are here. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. That's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson, John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @FruCool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour.
So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Goodbye from me. and goodbye from these two doom-mongering harbingers of the imminent death that awaits us all.
Bye.
Goodbye.